Hello, nerds. Improv nerds, that is. It's me, Sean Diston, one of the hosts of this podcast that you're listening to. I'm sitting in the training center. I'm in a writer's room. I've got my feet up on a table like a piece of shit. What am I doing? This is weird. The podcast doesn't normally start this way. Well, I'm recording sort of an intro to the cold open just because this episode's a very special episode. We talked to improv guru, person I refer to as Ardell Close, Chris Gethard. And man, we went so long in fact, that we're breaking up this episode into two parts. So what you're about to hear is part one of the Chris Gethard interview, and it's a special interview because we only use audience questions, and man, do we get into some very interesting, would I say controversial topics? You're going to have to listen to find out, and it'll probably end in the middle of sort of, you know, it'll end abruptly, but remember, the second half will be coming out next Monday, so don't you fret, improv nerds. And, you know, always go to iTunes, leave reviews, all that good stuff. Cool. All right, I'm going to keep sitting here and pretending I'm a king. There's no one else in the room, that's just the way I live my life. So feed the nerds. Enjoy.
Sean's not really conducive to
Whoa.
Crying.
I am. That is right? Not this true.
Is That's room. Definitely true.
This is a bizarre room.
This is a very bizarre room to cry in. I'll tell you that. You seem like you're an insane assassin.
You could lock a person in here.
Yeah.
Are we ready?
We are ready.
All right.
Wait, we're not doing a cold open?
I think.
You just want to get the question. You want
no,
to get
no,
no.
We normally. Well.
What?
Chris, normally.
Do you want to record the cold open afterwards?
No,
is that
the
plan?
Cold open is normally just what's happening right now. So basically, it's just us talking before we officially start the podcast. Does that make sense? A lot of times we talk about TV shows.
Do we often talk about TV
shows? Oh, yeah. We've talked about Friday Night Lights and many of
that's
them.
That's it.
I will
but
say,
that's just Friday Night Lights.
I will say, Chris Gethard, talk about influence. Mm-hmm. I watched Friday Night Lights because Gethard told me to finish the first episode. I didn't finish it.
JD made the same mistake. Yeah, He's like, that show's about football. It's dumb. I don't care. And I was like, you didn't finish the first episode.
I turned it off 45 minutes in, and then I remembered
it's like minute 47.
And then I remember hearing Gethard be like, you got to finish the first episode. Finish the first episode, and then the rest is history. All I talk about is
Friday
Night Lights.
The Americans?
No.
No, Chris watched it without me.
I want to, though.
That's
it's on AMC.
Show.
FX.
That's the jam.
I've heard it's so good.
Ooh. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck. Well, that's a long form conversation. Recorded at UCB Comedy Studios in New York City. This is the Long Form Conversations Podcast with your hosts, Sean Diston and Nicole Dressbell. This is how we do the podcast.
Was I supposed to participate
in
that?
No,
you did
perfectly.
You did
is
right.
Do people usually participate
yes.
in that?
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. I just jumped. I horned in.
No,
hello,
no, you should.
America. Hi, improv nerds around the world. Welcome back to the Long Form Conversations podcast. We didn't have an episode, or we did have an episode last week.
We didn't have one 2 weeks ago.
And I'm very sorry about that.
Did we
that.
Account for ourselves about that? Or
we
did
probably
we just...
did. I'm just doing it again because I feel guilty. But today we have a very special episode. In many of our episodes that we've recorded, someone gets brought up a lot. A person who has influenced many performers at this theater. He's putting his hands up like, what can I say? You know, you've already heard him. Ladies and gentlemen, improv guru, I'd say for many people, he's sort of Ardell Close. Chris Gethard is here.
Thank you so much, Sean. But Nicole and I both immediately made a face indicating that that is not true.
No, we made different faces.
That. You might think that. But
yours looked like it's not true. My face looked like, oh, good for you.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I think the truth is you might not feel that way, but there are people that look to your sort of influence as like foundation, like their foundation of being at the UCB.
I don't think it's crazy.
No, not at all.
That's very nice. I'm no Del Close. I think I actively actually saw myself maybe becoming a little bit of a guru, and that's a bit of when I backed out of teaching.
Mm.
I think that's was a little bit conscious, because I feel like when I was teaching, I go all in. Like, I go all in.
Well, let me stop you here, because today's episode is very specific, because only have audience
I'm
questions.
I'm really sorry.
No, but we have an audience question that
a lot of people probably wanted to hear the end of that, and they're now mad at you
No.
I want to hear the end of that,
and
I'm mad.
Listen. I'm just going to attribute it to a question, because we did have a question from Glo Tavares who asked, would you ever teach again? And I think it leads to this answer. I just wanted to throw the question. I was going to ask this question.
You just wanted to explain to people what we're doing, which is we're not doing a traditional backstory with Gethard. We're taking our questions, audience questions, some voice memo questions.
Right. And we can start with the first one, since we've already led into it. Will you ever teach a class again?
My gut instinct tells me no. Mm-hmm. That being said, there's two situations where I've been known to return from teaching. One is if I have like a particular itch that I need to scratch, like an idea, something where I want to see how it goes. And that, I think parentheses was that in a big way. I know that's a class that's become kind of mythologized in many ways. Mm-hmm. The other times I return to teaching are, of course, when I run out of money.
Right.
When I have a specific thing I want to pay for in my life that I can't justify spending the money on, and then I will come back.
Right.
So that's a thing that I have a question about, less about coming back and more about leaving. Because have you ever... So talk about why you've left when you've left first.
Okay. And I'll tell you this. I'm going to get real.
Yeah.
Please. I'm going to dance around these answers like Catherine Mudon did. Okay? I'm not going to pussyfoot around the real dirt like Mudon did.
Did you listen to one fucking podcast and that was it?
The Mudon one. No, I listened to a bunch because I was trying
to...
That's
so funny.
Because here's why I'm here today. We were on the set of Broad City and we were all hanging out. And you guys told me that there was one time where parentheses came up and Nicole cried.
Yeah.
And then out of my own sense of ego, my need to fuel my own ego, I tried to look for that moment. And I actually really enjoyed the podcast and wound up listening to a whole bunch of them.
Okay, great. Okay, and then really the reason why you're here is because you then sent us an email about something Catherine said in the podcast that nobody
Catherine
remembers.
Catherine insinuated that I stole an exercise from someone. And
go
it's
ahead and
patently
clear that
not
up
true.
Right now. Let's
if there's one thing anybody can vouch, you guys knew me at my tail end of time here. If there's one thing, it's that I'm constantly fueled by a chip on my shoulder.
And then
if I don't have, if my life is too happy, I need to look for chips on my shoulder at all times.
Right.
So I invented one, which was that Catherine made some offhanded comment that I think was, I can't remember who did this exercise, this person or that person. And in my mind, I'm like, she's saying I'm stealing exercises.
Because that's not,
this is not reality. No, and I've never claimed to work totally from a place of reality.
That email was so funny to get. Because, and this happens to Sean and I a lot, when we get questions about things that were on the podcast, it's literally like if somebody walked up to you and asked you a question about a conversation you had 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. And because you sent that email, I was like, I don't fucking know what you're talking about.
I was mostly just trying to make you guys laugh. Obviously. I don't particularly care.
To be clear, it was also the second time that week I'd gotten a complaint about something said on the podcast.
Really?
So it did not have the intended effect.
Other thing we didn't remember.
Controversial.
Yep.
But yeah, let's talk about why you stepped away from teaching.
Okay. There's a few reasons I stepped away from teaching. One, and I'll just be very honest. I'll just be very real. I mean, one is that I started performing at UCB, I think the same, or I took my first class the same week as my 20th birthday. I think I stopped teaching when I was, 31, 32? That's like 11 or 12 straight years of my life, where I was doing improv multiple times a week, teaching improv multiple times a week, usually coaching multiple times a week. And, you know, I hit a wall. I hit a wall. And I think also... It's like you can't forget, I was like the school administrator. I wrote the curriculums. I think Anthony King wrote a pass on the level one curriculum. I wrote the first drafts of all the rest of them, and I think the second drafts of all the curriculums. There probably are more curriculums at this point, but at that time. So it wasn't like I was just like in it. I was saturated. It was my whole life. It was how I thought about the world. It was my viewpoint. It was where I grew up, you know? At some point, you live that way, you're going to hit a wall. I've always been very, very prone to like emotional problems and big mood swings. And I think there maybe was a stretch where, you know, you tend to let things represent bigger things in your mind, and that's not always reality. I think maybe teaching was the fact that I was teaching was maybe underlining some of my own limitations or lack of success to me, which is probably unfair looking back on it. But I will say what I was going to say before was like, I go all in to a degree where like, if I'm teaching a class and I'm sitting there lesson planning it, Like, I would skip an audition. I'll skip a commercial audition because I'm like, I don't really want to do that commercial, but I really want to teach this class. And in my mind, integrity is more important than money. So, like, I'll do the thing I really care about, and I don't need to go to this audition. I'll make up an excuse. But then I think about that afterwards, and I'm like, that's complete self-sabotage. You know what I mean? And then I start to think about, well, what about all the other things? What about all the writing? What about all the brainstorming? What about all the other stuff that isn't someone else telling me to do it, but is stuff that I should be self-starting on that I'm not doing because I'm so obsessive about teaching? So there was that. And then there was also an incident. I mean, there's also, there's a few other things. One is UCB is a great place, my home. I don't visit so much anymore, but it always feels like home when I come back, and it means the world to me. I will say I was always a little bit of a troublemaker, and I think always a little bit like, it gets tossed around a lot where people roll their eyes at the phrase, but I think punk rock was always like an important thing to me, and UCB felt like that to me when I got there. And I think it still has elements of that, but I don't know if you can say that it's the CBGBs anymore. You might say it's like the Mercury Ballroom at this point, or like the Bowery Ballroom. Like, it's legit. So also started to feel to me like it was maybe like a little tougher to find some of the rabble rousers that I would always latch on to. I think maybe they are like, the system's a little, there's so many people, it's harder to locate those people. And then there also was an incident where there had been some auditions, and I won't name any names. Okay. I think a couple of people in this room might know.
Oh, I definitely know.
I don't.
But so there were some auditions for Harold Teams, and a student of mine, I got a text from a number I didn't know, and someone calling me a liar. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then I found out who it was. It was a student of mine who said, you told me I'm getting good. You guys are just trying to take my money. I'm wasting all this time. You said I was getting good. I didn't even get a call back or something like that, something along those lines. And that really broke me emotionally because, you know, there is an element of this, which is this is an acting school and people are learning skills comedically, acting-wise. I think you can also learn a lot of life skills. There's also an element where I think you have to be really, really careful that you're not writing the curriculums that turn into a cult or a pyramid scheme. And those jokes get tossed around a lot. And I don't think that's true. Fundamentally, I don't think that's at the core of what we do or what this is, but it definitely can have shades of that on its darkest days. And that incident really, I mean, you can imagine, you guys both right. know how much, like, if I get in somebody's corner, the students who I really loved, I was notorious for playing favorites and just, like, pushing people as hard yeah. as I could into the spotlight before they were ready just to get them there. And I'm always proud of that. But when someone who maybe had some of that status said that to me, I really took it seriously and it really broke me. So that's hit a wall, had that incident as maybe like a little bit of an exciting incident.
Yeah.
I was already there. I was already feeling like my classes weren't as good as they used to be, which is when it's time to hang it up, you know?
I think you touched on something interesting, like sort of one of the major issues at UCB is that to contribute to the community of teaching and cultivating talent will always take away from your own professional opportunities.
You have to sacrifice. You have to be selfless.
You really do. And I think that's so interesting because I feel like, I mean, I might be wrong, but I feel like the more legit UCB becomes and the more of a sort of talent pool that this place becomes, the harder and harder it is to find people that can stick around and invest in the school and in the students. So I just think it's interesting, like
right, as teachers. You mean.
As teachers,
I mean, that was.
Right.
I remember that really. I would say that really started being a problem when I was running the school, and once the LA theater opened up, that really became
because
a
then
problem.
Everyone went to LA.
Because the most talented people are going to go to LA, and the most talented people are also the people who are the most sought after teachers. So much of the time, you know, losing guys like Joel Wengert and Curtis Gwynn, and I mean, everybody was gone. But yeah, I mean, that sacrifice. I always think. You know, I think it's a person who everybody respects and there's so much love. There was also so many people in New York, there's like maybe just like a little bit of unnecessary fear about Anthony King because he was such a good artistic director and people were so nervous and wanted him to like them. But there's a guy who, I mean, I would say maybe more than anybody, he just started getting people jobs, you know? People got jobs because of the way he ran the theater in a real way.
And I always think good jobs, not just like good jobs, quality technical jobs.
Quality stuff. But I always think about there's so many of those jobs that he helped other, he helped facilitate for other people that he could have just taken and left if he felt like it.
Yeah.
That guy pushed his own career back, I'd say probably like 3 or 4 years to turn this place into what it is.
I do think that is part of why you touched on it, like that Anthony King looms so large for so many people is because there was like, he had status. He also was just super smart and right all the time and had integrity. And he had good taste and he had integrity.
An insane amount of integrity.
Yeah. I
want Anthony King's approval more than my dad's approval.
I think looking back, even people who were at the time maybe intimidated by Anthony King, I think people looking back are very appreciative of him.
Yes.
And realize that that intimidation was, I think, way more often than not, it was not him being intimidating. It was everybody really taking his opinions so
and
seriously.
And him unyielding in his opinions.
Yes, unapologetic. I think one of the main things about him, too, it's like, it's so funny because I think your guys' generation really, you guys were like trying to get on teams under him and it was just like he was that guy. I didn't have to deal with that, but I it's like so funny because I think back to it, and he put everybody's feet over the flames. Like, I coached Anthony before he started taking UCB classes, and we always had a very, very honest and special relationship because of that. He and I could always speak to each other very frankly, always pull each other aside, either as friends or as professionals, and we would always constantly bounce things off each other kind of behind closed doors. It really helped me through a lot of things. But that being said, I once did a spank of a show, and he made me do the spank again, even though we had that relationship. And he was directing the show. So a show that I was in that he was directing, when it went up, he was like, this is not good enough. You and I need to take my notes
Holy
and make
shit.
It better. So I think that's one thing.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, I think it was very interesting from my vantage point to see that some of the younger generation really just like wanted his stamp of approval. And maybe sometimes that twisted into a thing where people were nervous around him. But for me, I'm like, well, if they knew that he holds... I think it's fair to say I was one of the top dogs at the theater at that time. And he was directing it. There's no world in which he couldn't have been like, hey, I think me and you are going to find this one. Let's start the run and put it on its feet. He's like, nope. Second spank. Do it. Do it. We're doing it. And we sat down and we rewrote and we re-rehearsed. And then we went back up. And when it was good enough, he gave it a run.
Yeah. And I think part of his sort of unrelenting sort of like stance on what he thinks is funny or what he thinks is good improv translated to stage. Like the people he ended up championing and putting on stage were that generation's great teachers and great performers.
Yeah, he really knew what he was doing.
Yeah, totally. Well, let's get into another question.
I actually, I want so much to go through a bunch of the things that you
please.
Just said.
Okay.
Okay, so I think that point is really, really interesting about integrity, missing auditions, and specifically missing auditions for class stuff. Of like integrity versus self-sabotage.
Mm-hmm.
How do you recognize when it's one or the other? Or does there just come a point where you realize it doesn't matter? You have to take yourself out of the game so it's not a question anymore by not teaching.
Well, you know, I can only speak to my personal experience. But for me, suffering real true anxiety about a lot of things. And as I kind of unwrapped that, both personally and with the help of the shrink I started seeing in 2007, which I think I quit teaching maybe for the first time around 2008. It was like, you know, it's a crutch. Is it a crutch? It's like, I think the question you have to ask yourself is like, are you doing things to be working with people you think are great? Are you doing these to further your community, to give back? Or are you doing this because you feel like there's nothing else you can do?
And this bolsters your ego.
Yeah. are you hanging on? Like for me, I was like, I think this, this is a big fish, small pond thing for me. Like I know that people regard me as a good teacher and I can do this and I can build this element of my life where, people look up to me and I have status in this world, but is status in this world what I want? I don't think status in this world is important. I think I've always been very, very much a champion of that. I think a lot of times at UCB, one of the inherent problems of a class system is that there's this ladder of where do you belong in the food chain? And I think that's a construct. But ultimately, I didn't want that. Ultimately, I saw a lot of my friends and peers doing a lot of great things, and I was always very happy for them. But what I felt was like a magnifying glass that ultimately, I think ultimately I was like kind of putting myself under a microscope looking back on it. And I had to just kind of admit, this is a thing I can always have. And, but it's not necessarily what I want.
Yeah. It's the safe bet.
Yeah.
Over
it's
the,
like, do you keep dating the person who's dating you? Cause you don't know if there's anything else out there. Do you, you know, ultimate at some point break up with them and go get out into the world, you know? And I think I needed to do that.
And I guess commitment and integrity to a thing that isn't the path that you want to be on.
You're not doing anyone any favors.
Right.
To me, ultimately, that's how you wind up being bitter. That's how you wind up being at the end of the line, like, you know, talking about the good old days and talking about all the shots you missed. You know what I mean? It just kind of felt like I always had it in my head. I always knew. I was like, man, like, I love it so much. I really love teaching. I genuinely do love it so much. It's the only thing I ever did that I felt naturally good at ever in my entire life. So I remember thinking so much of like, this will always be here. And if I leave, it was interesting. My shrink gave me the best advice. She was like, you got to quit doing all that. I was writing freelance for magazines. I was teaching, doing this and that. She's like, anything that's not what you want to be doing, if you make money from it and it's not your end goal, you have to quit. And I was like, that's such a bad idea. I'm going to not have rent. And she was like, well, look, you want to be writing, you want to be acting, you want to be doing stuff, and you don't know if you can. She's like, if you go out there and you have no other options, if you give yourself no other options, you have to do it or not do it. But at that point, I was 27 or 28, and I'd been doing this for close to a decade. It's like there's no sitting on the fence waiting anymore. So she was like, go and do it. And if you do it, then you'll be happy that you managed to do it, which I think is ultimately what happened. And she's like, and if you don't make it work, then you can come back to this thing you love, and you can do it without all the internal questions about what if I left. Right. You got to leave at some point to answer the question, what happens if I leave? And for me, I think that was a really huge thing. So I wouldn't be surprised if I came back to teaching, but it might not be for like 10 or 15 more years. I always had that in my head of like, I'd love to do this when I've kind of done all the other things that I feel in my heart that I need to do.
You don't have to answer this, but because you just posed a lot of legitimate problems to walking away.
Yeah.
How do you pay rent during the period of time when you are jumping and hoping a net appears?
It's completely terrifying. It was really, really terrifying. It was also, did I have health insurance? There was a year and a half or 2 years where I didn't have health insurance, which I know many people don't have it for longer than that. It's terrifying. But I had some savings. I had always been smart about savings. And I quit teaching. And I don't even really remember. I was just hustling and grinding. I remember like working this one job. This company found me and they'd throw me these weird writing jobs that would pay the rent for like a month. I remember once writing, it was like they were going to do a reality show about, remember the football player Chad Ochocinco?
Oh, yeah.
He's like a weirdo football player.
He's from Miami, Florida.
Chad Johnson changed his name to Ochocinco because that was his number, 85, which I don't think is the actual way you say 85 in Spanish.
Ochocinco.
But they were like, it was like, there's going to be a reality show about Ochocinco and we need jokes. So it was like me coming and sitting in a room that was legit like this, but without foam walls, but no windows. And it was just like, just write jokes that Chad Ochocinco could say all day. And I handed them over and that went on for 2 weeks. And it's like, okay, I can live for another 6 weeks because I wrote these weird jokes. A lot of stuff like that. A lot of commercial auditioning really got me through. That world can be very demoralizing because you're treated like, you know, you walk in and they're like, sorry, your head's too big, you know, like, or sorry, your hairline's like, quarter inch too far back. We want someone whose hairline's receding, but it's just like you get judged. But again, easy life problems. But yeah, it was a grind. And I'll never ever forget that I was really trying to make it happen. And I hit a point where I looked in my bank account. I gave myself a certain amount of savings where I'm like, this is my safety net. And then I put the rest in a checking account. And I was like, that checking account is what I have. this is what happened. Like, this checking account is that. And then that's the safety net where if I bottom out, that's what I rebuild with. That's to make sure, like, while I start applying for new jobs or get back in rhythm of classes mm-hmm. or whatever I start doing, this is, like, basically my failure money. This is, like, I save this money so I can go fail and know that I can give myself 3 or 4 months to get back on my feet when I do. So I had this checking account, and it was the summer of 2009. So it had been, I think, about a year since I quit everything and went on this journey. And I hit a point where I looked at the checking account. It was the only time in my adult life where if I had, like, if the landlord knocked on the door, I didn't have my rent. Which was like, I was living in Woodside, Queens, in a room with no closet with a roommate. It was like $600, $700. Looked in the checking account. I was like, I don't have $700. And I just sat on my couch and I started crying. And I remember I called Joe Mandy, stand up, very good friend of mine. And we just kind of commiserated. I think he and I were both in a similar spot of just like, man, all our friends are moving on. People keep saying, like, I think in that stand-up world, people were like, well, you're the next Kroll or Mulaney. And in the improv world, it was like, oh, you're the next, you know, all your buddies, Bobby and Zach, they're all moving on. You're the next one in line. I just cried, and we talked all night. And then, no joke, the end of that week, it was so fascinating. It was like Adam McKay was doing a movie. And when he does auditions, he likes people to improvise. So he was auditioning in New York, and I was at the same agency that represented him at the time, obviously insanely further down on their list of priorities, but he called the New York comedy agent there. He was like, is there anybody who's really good at improv? Because we like to do these improv things. And she called me and she's like, oh, you should go do this. You'll get to like see how he runs auditions. And we went, and I was improvising with all the people who came in, just reading the lines, and then when they wanted to go off lines, I was just there to be a competent improviser to like help them further stuff and then carry them back to the lines when I could tell they were looking for it. Very cut and dry job. And he just, I guess, thought I was funny, and he offered me a part in The Other Guys. And that paid me enough. That was my first ever movie role, and that paid me enough to get through the end of the year. And then the end of that year, again, McKay and Farrell remembered me from The Other Guys, and that's why they gave me the shot to audition for Big Lake, which I know in like the narrative of my story has become like this thing that was an unpleasant experience, and to some degree it was. But what I always fear is that when those guys read that they feel like I don't appreciate the opportunity, because the truth is it was 10 episodes of a sitcom, and I've always been a believer in, like, I have to live below my means if I want to do this. If I want to be an artist, not only can I not spend only what I make, I have to live a more humble lifestyle than what I make, whatever that is. And Big Lake became this windfall that allowed me the breathing room for everything I've done since in a big way.
Yeah. That's a fascinating. Awesome.
Thank you for answering that, because people are weird about talking about money, and I think that's how the man keeps us complacent.
Think so, but for me, it really was. I lived it, stuck to it. There was a lot of stress, and it was legitimate. It was legitimate. When I got to the end of the line, someone came along and became a champion for me, looked out for me.
Yeah.
And I don't think it could have happened any other way.
It's also very fascinating how often that story, there are parallels for that with many, many people I talk to in that position. I was at rock bottom, and I finally, because you give yourself no other option, it ends up paying off.
Yeah.
But that's great. Can we move on to some more questions?
Totally.
We solicited some questions.
Is this boring?
No, not.
You said that in a way where I feel like it's boring people.
Gether, you have no idea.
I think, can I tell you what's happening? I think Sean is like, oh, shoot, we have like a cool format for the show and we haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just.
And I don't have all the time in the world. I'm a busy person.
Exactly. This guy is working. But we had our listeners send in some audio clips of themselves asking questions. I don't know why we thought that would be a good idea, but I just thought it'd be interesting.
I like
that. They want to be on
the
podcast. So let's ask our first question from Cameron Azarm, friend of the show. And I think I want to ask the question about coaching.
What is the key to great coaching? And do you think it requires an emotional investment towards the team?
And I think this is specifically towards house teams, because you've coached many house teams.
I have. And also an improviser. One of the angry, do you know this story? That there's someone who once said, they refused to have me coach their team because they said I kill teams.
No.
And it's like, oh no, I don't kill teams. I get in the trenches with horrible teams and I stick with them.
Right.
And I don't bail on them.
Whoa,
and then they eventually get broken up because they're not working.
Right. I didn't know that people say that. Ooh, no. I can't
Someone
wait to ask who it was later.
Someone said that.
I mean, you did coach Dybbuk.
I did.
Which could not have been a more dead man walking team.
Everyone was just too polite. Everyone was too gentle, too polite. But yeah, coaching. So coaching is a thing that I'd like to think I'm pretty good at. I think many people might point to me as someone who's kind of like set the bar for a while. I think you do have to have an emotional commitment. I think it's one of the things that's different between coaching and teaching is that you are in some sense a part of the team. Whenever a coach doesn't go to see people's shows on a regular basis, if it's like, I'll coach you, but I'm not going to come see your shows, I think that's a little bit of a cop-out. I don't think you're really coaching. I think you're probably doing workshops with those people.
Do you think that's just specific to house teams, or you mean indie teams too?
I think, I mean, if an indie team says we want to be a group that's actively performing and we're looking for a coach to guide that process, then I think a coach, someone who signs on, should get on board with that as a process.
Cool.
If not, call it a workshop or something else like that. House teams in particular, though, it's just like, do it or don't do it. So yeah, I feel like one of the main things about coaching that makes it not teaching is that there is an emotional investment. Whenever I coached a team, I'm like, I want this team to be better than all the other teams. I don't apologize for how competitive UCB can be. I'm like, I'm coaching a team. I want it to be the best team. Yeah. I want to talk shit to the other team's coaches.
Can you clear up the myth of the Fuand? You told them that they weren't. People have said, all right, so you coach Fuand, great team at the theater. The story goes, and I might be butchering it, you told them that people didn't think they were smart enough to do
that
organic.
Anthony King didn't think they were smart enough. You're dancing around it.
Oh, I didn't know if that
was
true.
The version I heard is that you told them Anthony King says you're not smart enough.
Yeah. What? So is that the type of psychological...
Did you do that, and or if you didn't, would you do that?
I did do that.
Great.
I would do it again. The real question is, did he say that?
Which is no, right?
It's not no. It wasn't as harsh as I said it.
Gotcha.
It was some, I think I maybe had, Fuand was a team, like Gabrus is a rugby player.
Right.
Shannon's a bruiser who grew up with three older brothers. A lot of people on
they
that team.
They respond to that kind of bulletin
A lot of people
board
on that team want to, even Kevin Hines. Kevin Hines, who's like such a great straight man on the team. You don't think of the straight man as like one of the, like Kevin Hines is a dude who like wants to take the gloves off. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I knew that that would motivate them. I believe Anthony said something more akin to, I see what you're trying to do and you might need a team that's a little more cerebral than this one.
Ooh.
Like this team might be a little bit more instinctive or a little bit more energy based, and what you're aiming for might not be that. It's probably a little bit closer to that. Did I cliff notes that down to Anthony emailed me and said, you guys aren't smart enough to pull this off? I did. It wasn't entirely untrue, and it was boiled down to the essence that I knew would get them to fight. And also, here's a story. I know that that's become like UCB myth that no, but I'll also say this, for as much as that's like me being this manipulator that pushed them, I also, weeks after that, they were doing shows that were so terrible, really unwatchable. And these were great players. They were embarrassing shows. And I went to them and I said, this is not good. And it's hurting you guys and it's hurting your standing at the theater. And we should stop doing it. And I'm going to tell Anthony it was my fault and I was pushing you, which to some degree was true, not totally. And to their credit, they all, Kevin and Shannon first, were like, fuck that. Is that okay if I curse?
Of course.
They were just like, no, we're doing it and we're going to get it right. And everybody else, nobody hesitated. Nobody blinked. And that was like, Tim, and again, I think it loops back to the question asked, which is like coach, like teaching, you don't have those moments. Teaching, it hits 6 o'clock. Hey, I'm off the clock.
Right.
If I give you anything else extra, it's because I'm giving you more of my time voluntarily. Coaching is like, no, we have a scheme. We have a plan. Let's do it. And it's my job. It's also inherently less people. If I'm working with 8 people instead of 16, I know those 8 people inside and out. I know how that person interacts when they're on stage with that person. Or when that person's on stage with those two other people, how it's different than those two other people. I know how all these moving parts fit together ideally. And it's my job to be able to diagnose all of that and kind of be in the booth watching all of that and kind of, and for me, coaching, you're almost like in the tides of the show, in the comings and goings of the show, the rhythms of the show, as much as if you were on stage when you're really clicking with a coach. They feel like they're a part of it. You know, they feel like they're on the sideline.
Yeah.
How much does your coaching style change depending on the team? Because like that, you said you knew based on who was on Flawed that like...
For me...
And how quickly does it take you to read a team and the style of coaching they're going to respond
well,
to?
Well, how arrogant do you want me to be?
Well, I've
more than anybody else.
Exactly. Right. And I think because of that, there have probably been phases of how you've coached teams.
There have been.
Like towards the end, I feel like you were coaching more towards what boundaries you wanted to push or how you wanted.
Definitely.
You know what I mean?
And I think that's also towards the end why I went back to teaching, because there were situations where I was coaching like that. And it didn't work. But I think the answer is that I can ascertain very quickly how people deal with each other. I think my instincts are pretty on target a lot of the time. I think if I do a 3-hour workshop with somebody, I can probably give them a note that's personal to them by the end of it. And this is not me trying to be arrogant. It's just I think I have put in more reps as a coach and teacher, maybe more than anybody.
And those reps aren't just mindless reps. I feel like every time you're doing it, you're 100% invested.
Yeah.
Which makes it even more sort of valuable time.
Like I can tell you, I'll tell you two stories. I don't think any of these people would mind it. Like the worst job I ever did coaching was the opera, because I totally misdiagnosed what they needed. And I came out of the gate with some motivation that actually crippled that team from the start. I blame myself for that team not being the best team. That should have been one of the best teams ever.
Do you think part of that was that you had, because I think a lot of people you'd work with were on that team.
They
right?
were.
And do you think you had too many preconceived notions going in and didn't have time to figure out the lay of the land as they apply to each other?
I probably geared the team towards the mentality of Don, Michael Caine, and Elena, because I knew them so well. And I knew all three of those people are people where I'm like, I knew them and I knew their interests and I knew my relationship with them to the point where I know those three enough where I'm like, okay, like that's where the bullets are and that's where they want to go. Not everybody on that team was like that. I didn't take enough time to know that. But I also, effectively what I did was I gave them a big speech. Three teams had been formed, and they were the superstar team. That was the 8 sure things. The other two teams, there was a descending order of what everyone in the whole community expected from those three teams, and it was almost entirely flip-flopped from what happened. The team everybody thought had the potential to be a real disaster, a team that I completely misdiagnosed and said, are we sure we want to make this team? Because there's some young players on here. Do we want to put them in a situation that seems like it could be real drama? That team became Santino.
Right.
Team was great. I was wrong. I'm wrong a lot of the time. Any arrogance I have about coaching and teaching is also I'm wrong a lot of the time. And those stories don't get told. But yeah, the opera, I basically said, you guys are the 8 sure things. You got to, all eyes are on you, man. Like you guys are the ones setting the bar. So let's go out there and let's prove that that's correct. Looking back on it, there's some people on that team who I think weren't ready for that, who maybe hadn't had their skins weren't thick enough yet. So yeah, I totally fucked up with that team. Mm-hmm. And then another reason why I knew it was time to stop coaching was I was coaching Dance Break, and they brought me in, and I was roommates with Phil Jackson at the time, and I really loved a lot of people on. I did coach Dance Break. That was the one with Beyer.
Yeah.
Yes. What was the one that Phil was on with Patrick Noth?
Regulars.
The regulars.
Yes.
The regulars brought me in. And they said, like,
I picked up coaching them right when you left coaching.
Yeah, they were not psyched about our relationship, some of them. That was another time where it was like, I think I half messed up and they half messed up. That was the last team I coached. I'll probably never coach a house team again. Because they brought me in, they were like, I was living with Phil, and Phil sat me down. He's like, we were all talking, we really want to push it, this and that, blah, blah, blah. You're the guy. I was like, I love everybody on the team, let's do it. And then what became clear when we got in there was that that had not been a universally agreed upon thing with that team.
Yeah.
And if it was, some of them didn't understand that I tend to maybe tinker with things to a level that can get psychological at times, and that's not pleasant, and that's not fun, but it's aimed at getting better results on stage. And they wrote me and said, Phil didn't write, it was very awkward living with Phil over these 2 days, but someone else on the team wrote me and said, hey, we just want to go back to doing a regular opening and not do all the stuff that, because, you know, it was kind of modeled after the stuff I had been building in the classes that led up to Parentheses and Parentheses itself. We don't want to do that anymore. We want to go back to our old opening. I was just like, well, then I'm not your guy, because I'm not really, I don't want to just come give you notes on an invocation or whatever you're doing at this point. Like, we were aiming to do this other stuff.
I think, again, this was later in the period where you were more interested in working on.
I was going to say, and that's when I realized that, because I even said, I was like, it seems like this is really born out of fear. So when you're not worried of it, you're not scared of it anymore, you let me know. And I thought they were going to be like, fuck that, let's go. We're not scared of anything. And they were just like, cool, we'll let you know. And that was a time where I had to realize, like, oh, my priorities are very different than the priorities of this system. And I can do things like parentheses, which is of the system, but intentionally outside of it, on the fringe of what it usually is. I can do that. But if my goal is to kind of have my own agenda and my own interests, I can't be mad if people say that's not in their interest.
Right.
They had maybe convinced themselves it was in their interest, and then it wound up not being, and then it became kind of a rocky conversation. But yeah, I'm not perfect as a coach, but I think I give a shit more than most people.
I think part of the reason that you're saying you may never coach a house team again is because the system of which we have the house teams now aren't really acclimated to pushing it in the way.
I can say this from my vantage point. House teams need to survive, and they worry too much about surviving. You can't have. They feel like they can't have a bad show, and it's terribly disappointing to me. It makes me really sad. To every great team I can ever remember had many, many terrible shows. And I would really love to think in my heart, especially now that Shannon O'Neill's the one at the helm, that teams that fail in the sake of individualism, uniqueness, experimentation,
mm-hmm.
that's how you get to the great places. And I think me as a coach, maybe people started to say I kill teams because I don't allow it to just be
safe.
I don't want a B-minus Harold. I don't want a B-minus Harold. I want an A-plus Harold every time. I want a Harold that you can't even put on the regular grading chart because it's so fucking different.
One of the notes you've gave in one of the workshops you were teaching towards the end of your sort of teaching tenure was, like, you should never be satisfied with the middle. It's either extremely great or extremely terrible, and be okay with that. And I always thought, like, oh, yeah, it's like that fail big.
Yeah,
sort of.
Middle ground bullshit is like the enemy. The middle ground is the enemy. But I think if we're being totally honest, sometimes fear dictates house teams' choices, and it's better to be like reasonable. It's better to be pretty good than to be horrible. And I would agree with that in a vacuum. But to be great is better than all of it. And if being horrible, if your fear of being horrible is why you settle for pretty good. I vote for horrible. Pretty good is born out of insecurity and weakness then.
I think that's all great. I agree with all of that. How do you know? I'm thinking about teams that want to do really ambitious stuff but haven't demonstrated the technicals.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think fuck it, skip the technicals? Or do you think you need to go through like textbook heralds on your way to?
I think it's a really good question. I mean, I think you need to know how a herald works. You just need to know how it works.
As a group.
I think so. I think Fwand, I think, is the example of the one that got the weirdest along the way. Every player on that team had been on other teams, I think.
Right.
Maybe one or two people hadn't been around that much. But they'd all paid their dues and done their herald. So you need to know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, like, I always say this. Anytime I teach, I always wind up saying some version of, like, we've all been in a situation where you do a montage. It's great, fun, loose, no pressure, big hits, edits are on target, blah, blah, blah. Coach gives you no time. Everybody's feeling good. Let's do a Harold. Same exact assemblage of people in the same room 40 minutes later, and it's the biggest pile of uncomfortable dog shit you've ever done. Well, this means that the structure, you're being a slave to the structure. The structure is your slave. Everything about structures is to make your life easier. And if it's not making it easier, I don't see why you're being bound to it. Nobody's ever watched a show that was hilarious and intriguing and unique and good and been like, well, they skipped the second group game. It's never happened. There's been a lot of shows where people are like, awesome, you knew how to do an opening, three scenes, a group game, three scenes, group game, three scenes, tie it up, connections. Like, everybody's been bored by that at some point. So it's like, yeah, that is there. That is the training wheels, man. And it's like, yeah, if you have no discipline, then you probably shouldn't be fucking around. But I have to assume if you have no discipline, you're not getting on a team in 2015.
Right.
If you haven't demonstrated how to do a Harold. So I don't get why these people don't push themselves, man.
And I guess in a lot of ways, Lloyd Knight now should be doing that textbook work so that by the time you're all on a Herald team, you should be able to assume that you have that skill.
I think so. I mean, I'm also so out of touch that I don't know the mandates of the theater or what the theater is asking of anybody. I can only speak from the perspective of what I've always been, which is a little bit of a lunatic who has ideals that supersede everything. So Shannon's one of my best friends, and if she has to text me and be like, stop causing trouble on that podcast, I will take that text. I can only speak from the perspective of a historical rabble-rouser in this community.
I will only say, though, my only take on that is, a lot of times, like, drilling the fundamentals and, like, working only on that, like, can only get you so far, and only when you stop thinking about those things will they naturally happen in scenes. So, like, I've had people who might struggle in, like, textbook heralds or whatever. But as soon as I give them an assignment to, like, do something that they're really concentrating on, the other stuff falls into place because it's all, like, sometimes it's more in your bones than something you have to access in every moment. You know what I mean?
It's so true, and it's so frustrating. Yeah. So I'm coaching Big Time, which is a Lloyd team. Great group. We just did a month of heralds where it was, like, we would just do heralds in practice, so I didn't do exercises. It was so much more fucking productive and also fun. And also, I think they grew so much more than any other month we had together than all my dumb, stupid exercises.
Word.
I think part of it for me, too, part of why I'm such a fan of going on the attack, it's not, I don't care if some, I feel like everybody always says my shit's weird. I don't care if anything's weird at all. I think I've also coached people towards doing stuff that's incredibly heartfelt or that's paced differently than it usually is. The reason I like doing things differently is, like, A, if your chemistry as a group lends itself towards something, you should be seeking that out. The thing that gets me is that the ceiling that we often hit in this community is actually self-imposed. We convince ourselves that things are harder than they have to be. We convince ourselves that things are more important than they should be. Nobody cares if you mess up a Herald. How does it affect you or the world or anything, man? Once it's done, it's done. You flush it down the fucking toilet. It's improv. So to me, it's like we convince ourselves. When I came back from my first self-imposed teaching exile, after that initial time I quit, I came back. People don't know this. I came back for money. I came back. I had run out of money again. That's the class where I met Don and Catherine and Dom Manzalillo and Kane and Noah and all those people. All
right. And Jesse Lee.
Jesse Lee, my favorite.
Oh, that's another Jesse thing. Lee just ranked up another mention.
Here's another thing lost to time is everybody thought Don Finelli was my favorite. Jesse Lee was my favorite. Jesse Lee was my favorite.
I remember laughing at McManus about Jesse Lee ranting, drunk Jesse Lee ranting to Zach Woods, and Zach Woods looking at everyone and being like, this is the funniest guy I've ever met in my life.
He's the best. He's the best. And I'm glad he's...
Can we jump to another question real quick?
But wait, can I just say one thing?
Please.
Is that what I came back for money, but those classes really meant so much to me, all of them. And what I wound up doing, looking back on it, I was building this on my feet, was I was realizing, like, people have convinced themselves that there's things they're allowed to do and not allowed to do. And they're all guidelines and suggestions. There's no improv rule that you can't break. Who gives a shit? If you break it and it works, and someone yells at you, that person's a dickhead for yelling at you. If you break it and it doesn't work, then yeah, especially if it messes it up for your scene partners, you got to get a note on that. You're being selfish and you went for something, didn't worry. I've done that 1,000 times. But I'll never, ever forget in the class I taught that Love Band was in it after I came back from teaching. We were doing like an exercise, drawing ideas from openings. And we did it, and Bluff Band had this idea, and it was not good. Bluff Band don't care. Bluff Band's a really good friend of mine. He's one of my best friends at this point. He won't care about me talking about a class from years ago. Like, it was a strained scene, and he was putting all this pressure on himself. And I was like, well, why'd you pick that idea? And he was like, well, you know, someone said this, and then that said this, and these connected in this way, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I don't know, man. He's like, well, also this and that and blah, blah. And he's just going through, like, all the stuff from the curriculum, like all the things, like, here's how you pick ideas. And I was like, wait, did you think the idea was funny or good? Did you think it was a good idea or a funny idea? And he's like, not really. And I'm like, okay, this is my problem. People think the rules are what you have to check. But what you have to check is the rules enabling your creativity. So if you don't think an idea is good or funny, why are you using it? And I remember everybody in the class kind of stopped, and I kind of stopped. But I remember everybody in that class being like, we have to say something. Oh, we have to say something with it. And that kind of became a mantra of mine for a while. Like, great, you learned your scales, you learned the exercise, you got the muscles, say something. So for me, breaking the rules, walking away from the Herald is a natural thing if anybody's an actual artist, you know? other things sometimes that happens in this community, I think lately, and who am I to judge? And this is fucking old man Gethard, little too much. You guys tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, but around the time I was fading away, it was like, it seems like there's maybe some self-satisfaction on stage a little bit more than there should be of like, yeah, we nailed it. And that vibe rolls off stage of people feeling like they got the laugh. Where I'm like, you got to shut that down and say, okay, we set the bar there. Now let's use that as an opportunity to go even higher, go even higher.
Yes.
How much further can we set the bar before the lights go out?
I think the symptom, I think that's definitely a thing. I think part of the reason it happens is because people getting on stage are using, like, a lot of the people that end up on stage, when they get on stage, have the expectation that they need to imitate what they've seen on stage.
Yeah.
So people who are, like, on the back line and just like, oh, I love every moment of this thing, it's like, it's because they see that and they want to come off as feeling comfortable. It, like, to me, it comes out of nerves.
Yeah.
Like, I think that happens a lot. And then I think it bleeds into actually feeling like you've done, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I agree with that. I just think it's a shame because it's like as soon as that happens, as soon as people start like patting themselves, patting each other on the back, having that cocky vibe, that's where your show stops. However good that was, you've just said you're satisfied with that. Well, if you're satisfied with it, the audience now knows that that's where you're taking them because you're so satisfied. I always feel like one of the things about improv that I miss, and I don't miss much about improvising, but one of the things I miss is like, oh, any show could be the best show you ever do. So let's put the game face on and make it that. Every time you get to walk out there, it could be the best show you ever do. So as soon as it gets to that vibe of like, yeah, right, and everybody's like giggling at each other's moves, it's like, put your game face on because you just told me that we're only 12 minutes into this thing and you've pushed it as far as you're willing to take it because you're so satisfied with yourself. So don't do that. It's not appealing. Take me someplace where you didn't even know you could get to. You knew you could get here. I see it in your face.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that. Let's bring up, I have another question. I think it kind of relates to what we're doing now. You talked about not necessarily missing that many things from improv, but you still do a show. This question is about Sager and Gethard.
Oh, my favorite.
This is from Rachel Tansler. She asked a question.
Hello, my name is Rachel Tansler, and my question is about Sager and Gethard specifically. Whenever I see that show, I'm struck by how patient the improv is. You really get a sense that the entire scenes are being built line by line, and the listening is phenomenal. Is this something that you've tried to focus on in your improv in the past, or is this something that's happened with experience? I guess I'm just curious about your thoughts on patient, super hard listening in improv. Thanks.
Well, that's, great question. Thank you for that question, Rachel, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would say this is, first of all, Tammy Sager.
One of the best improvisers I've ever seen.
I recently, I did the movie with Birbiglia that was about improv, and Tammy and I were kind of, I think, Tammy and I, and Keegan had done Second City, I think was more of a sketch guy, but had an improv background, but we were the ones where people were like, how does this happen in improv, and this, and blah, 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 just like about the culture of it. And I remember saying that a lot of the people on that movie in one of these conversations, like Tammy wasn't around, and I was like, Tammy is, I think maybe all time, the number one draft pick if you're building a team. Specifically, if you don't know what kind of style you're about to play. If somebody's like, you got to walk on stage and it's going to be, you don't know what type of show it is.
Right.
Who do you want up there with you? I think you want Tammy Sager more than anybody. Because it's like, if you want to play game style, if you want to play premise, you want Besser, you want Joe Wenger. If you want to play game that's all about, like, if that, then what, you want Ian. If you want to do, you know, a super slow scene, you want TJ Jagodowski. If you want to do the experimental stuff, you want John Lutz. You know what I mean? You want the, like, transformational stuff, you want John Lutz. But if you don't know which one it's going to be, and you need to make sure that the person up there can do it all, take care of you, that's Tammy Sager.
100%.
All time. I don't know anybody who does more things better than Tammy Sager. I've never met anybody who can do a 60-minute long scene with Scott Adsit and then an hour and a half later go play Ass Cat and do the best tag outs and walk-ons the same night.
Yeah.
Never met anybody like that. So Tammy makes it very easy as the quick answer. I would also just say, yeah, like, there's certainly an element of selfishness in me only wanting to do a two-person show at this point in my life. Ass Cat's a very fun show, but It's a very interesting show because I think anybody who's ever been taught by me would say that it betrays almost every ideal of what I like about improv.
We still tell students, like, yeah, go to ASCAP, but that's not exactly what
I know. And
do.
I think maybe people emulate it, like we were saying before. I think it's one of the things they're emulating these days, for better or for worse. And it's great people, but it is tag outs and people messing with each other, people fuck with each other. Mm. It's not really... I don't know. And also, I was the guy who organized and booked ASCAP for a while. So I'd spend all day like texting people being like, please come do the show. And then nobody could come do it. And I have to scramble. And by the time I got there, I'd be frazzled. And then it would just be like a Tamanik and Bobby just tagging me out, which is great. Those guys are the best. And that's what the show is. But I think for me, the opportunity to get to a point where I can ask the theater, hey, can Tammy and I have an hour to just slow down and do what we want? To have gotten to the point where I can earn that luxury feels like, well, I'm certainly going to take advantage of it. And when I'm up here with Tammy, who's willing to take things in directions that might be uncomfortable or might veer away from comedy towards honest discussions or characters dealing with the aspects of their lives that aren't the funny part for 10 minutes out of the show, 10 whole minutes, Tammy will do that. So I'd be an idiot not to. So most of it is I'm extremely inspired by Tammy. Extremely inspired by her.
And your chemistry lends towards slow. I mean, the show itself lends towards playing slow. And is that something that you've like come into later on in your career as an improviser? Or did you always honor sort of the slower play and the...
I was always happy. I'd like to say I was very versatile. I think there was a certain point where there was a phase where I really wanted to slow down. Sometimes that's possible, sometimes that's not, and it's not really up to you. That was a lesson that it took me a very long time to learn. There was a stretch on The Stepfathers where I wanted everything to be like mess with a form and make it trippy in some way. And that was another harsh reality of like, not everybody wants that. Stop turning every show into like some fucking weird, like trying to make every show somehow like a cube. You know what I mean? Like where in my mind, I'm like, no, well, this scene, like they were all like that. And then backstage, people are like, we just want to fucking, people are here on, there's a bachelorette party. Yeah. I want to laugh. So those were some stretches of mine. But I think overall, I think I always, not necessarily slow, but what I would say is one thing I always pushed was believable, grounded. And not, like I always said too, one of the things I always said when I teach is like, not realistic, but believable. Even if something's absurd, I want those characters to believe that it's happening to them. I want them to believe it as much as we believe what's happening to us. I don't care if it's real. I've never pushed playing real, but I push believable in a big way. Convince me. If you're playing, you know, if you're playing two donkey pirates, whatever that is, they better give a shit about their lives as much as the audience gives a shit about theirs, or else you don't force your audience to watch it. You're wasting their time. You can do anything as absurd as you want, but the more absurd it gets, the more seriously you have to take it. So I think I've always wanted to do shows that felt very believable. And then on top of that, I'm notoriously not good at characters. So when I'm out there with Tammy, yes, I think we're just trying to keep it very, very grounded. And also all my characters tend to resemble me. Mm-hmm. So they tend to feel like very real, honest conversations. But it's definitely, there's a reason it's really the only show I do anymore. And it's because Tammy is very brilliant and I feel so challenged to be up there and in awe of the things that she constantly comes up with.
You've been listening to the UCB Longform Conversation podcast. If you haven't already subscribed, go ahead and do that. And you can also go to iTunes and leave a rating or review. That would really help us out. In the future, if you want to ask us questions or ask questions to our guests, you can follow us on Twitter at UCB Convo and look for postings there on future guests and future activity. Guys, I'm feeding the nerds left and right. We'll see you next week.